Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, how Arizona cities are trying to prepare for a series of new laws aiming to provide more housing.
And we meet a community orchestra made up mostly of retirees.
But first, Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays is following through on her promise to sue a Saudi Arabian company that has been pumping Arizona groundwater for years, mostly in order to grow alfalfa, a thirsty crop that they use to feed Saudi Arabian cattle. Fondamonte is the company, and Mays has made their practice of legally pumping groundwater in sometimes drought-ridden parts of Arizona a central issue since she took office 2 years ago. Now she's taking an untested legal theory to court to try to stop them.
When the legislature fails to protect our most basic resources, the Attorney General must step in. Public nuisance law exists for exactly these kinds of situations.
And KJZZ's Cameron Sanchez with our politics desk is covering it and joins us now with more. Hi there, Cameron.
Hi, good morning.
All right. So Fondamonte pumps groundwater in a lot of places around the state, and Mays has been investigating this practice for 2 years now. How does she plan on stopping them here?
Well, we heard in the clip she wants to do this as a public nuisance issue, and it's something that's somewhat untested, at least in this realm of going after a large company for groundwater pumping. She's saying that, you know, she's been working on this for quite a while now. She's been investigating for pretty much the entire 2 years, I think, on and off and in different parts of Arizona, not just this one company. And she's saying that it's still something that she can do, even though I think public nuisance is a misdemeanor. She wants to enjoin them from being able to do what they're doing now.
Sure. Okay. So they're doing this legally, right? Like, that's the trick here. They've gone through kind of the necessary steps they're supposed to go through to get the permits they need to pump this water.
That part, yes, but she's saying the illegal part about it, or what the court should find illegal, is that they're taking everybody's water and then causing damage to the health of the community.
And back up and remind us why this has made people so angry, like what they're doing with this groundwater.
So basically, this is a Saudi Arabian firm, and Fondamonte is using tons of Arizona land to grow alfalfa to feed cows, Saudi Arabian cows. And they're using a lot of groundwater because alfalfa just happens to be one of those crops that needs it. So they're using our water to grow crops that help, you know, their livestock. And the communities in rural Arizona are like, hey, we kind of want that water too.
Right. And they couldn't do this in Saudi Arabia, right, because of laws there. So talk about the impact on those communities in Arizona.
So as Mays sees it, it's a huge detriment because when you're taking all of the water out of a basin like the Renegros Plain Basin, which is in La Paz County, which is where this lawsuit is happening.
Right.
It sort of lowers the water for everybody else who's also using the same basin. So if you have wells that are attached to the same water basin and the water goes away, then, you know, your neighbor, John Smith, down the street is like, hey, did you use all of our water? Because my well is coming up dry. And that is what she says is happening. She says that there's a church, for example, which went dry in 2017 because of Fondamonte, which is about 2 miles away from their property. Also that it causes the land to sink and subside. And that makes it also harder to ever recharge the aquifer.
So can you recharge it? Like, is there any going back, Cameron, if they pump all of this groundwater?
It just takes a really long time and a lot of effort to do that. But it's not entirely impossible. Some of the damage is more permanent than others.
Yeah. Okay. So what would need to change then, Cameron, in state water laws to make this kind of practice more regulated?
There's a lot of things they could do, and there have been a lot of efforts to do it to regulate things through the state legislature. I think the governor would probably be amenable to that based on what she's said, and she and Mays have worked on, you know, sort of fighting against Fondamonte before. They did about a year ago over the land leases. But the state legislature has been the problem, as Mays sees it, because in particular, there's one committee that doesn't allow any of those bills to go forward.
Right.
And it's the House Natural Resources Committee. It's not just that one committee, technically, because there's a huge process around the legislature, but that's sort of the stopping point for bills that want to regulate water.
So what does this look like heading into a new session next year?
Well, I think the legislators are going to be upset by this, but they're going to have to watch it play out in court. And, they might join and, you know, file amicus briefs and give their two cents about it. But I think we're all just waiting to see what happens, because the court would be having to set their own, like, new precedent on this issue. And if that works in May's favor, she would be using it to go after other places, presumably with other lawsuits along the same lines.
Yeah, precedent there would be interesting. Okay, should we expect Fondamonte to fight this? What have they said?
Oh, yeah, completely. They filed a statement the same day that she announced her lawsuit. They said that these are unfounded, that they've always been, you know, good to the community, that they're following the rules, and that they are going to fight this in court.
Okay, but you say this is likely the beginning of what will be a long legal battle.
Oh, yeah. And it's not just the beginning of this legal battle. I think that she's going to go after other places as well. There's this mega dairy, so-called mega dairy, in, I believe, Cochise County that she also mentioned. She's not just looking at this one part of La Paz County. She's trying to do this for pretty much all of rural Arizona.
And this is because we're kind of looking at a pretty dire groundwater situation in the future, right?
Yeah, I also think it would make a really nice campaign sign.
All right. We will leave it there. Cameron Sanchez with our politics desk joining us to talk more about this lawsuit from the state attorney general. Cameron, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Some new state laws dealing with housing are set to take effect with the new year, and cities across Arizona are working to bring their ordinances into compliance. The measures aim to increase the supply of housing, among other things. They require more multifamily housing in certain areas and allow for more accessory dwelling units, or ADUs, commonly known as casitas, on lots. But there's been some debate as to whether the changes some cities are making actually align with the new state laws. With me to discuss is Tom Belshi, Executive Director of the League of Arizona Cities and Towns. And Tom, what are you hearing from city officials across the state about how they're trying to adapt their ordinances to these new state laws related to housing?
Well, you know, there was five really significant pieces of housing legislation that passed last year. And so, as always, they are working to be compliant with state law. And there's a lot going on at once. Some of this legislation, especially ones that require us to do studies, are going to be due at the end of this year. So there is a rush to complete that work, as well as work on changing their ordinances to be in compliance with the new state statute. So we're very enthusiastic about our ability to get the things done and be in a spot to start complying and helping with getting housing built. We don't build the homes, but we're trying to follow state statute to create a better situation for homes to be built.
Well, so have you found that cities are sort of taking similar approaches? Are you seeing any trends with how cities are trying to implement these new state laws into their city or town codes or ordinances?
One of the things that I appreciate about working at the League is that one of the big things that we do for the cities and towns is help them, especially with model ordinances. So, for example, House Bill 2720, it's an ADU, that bill that passed. Mm-hmm. For cities and towns, 75,000 and above, they can have, you know, depending on conditions, they can have up to three ADUs on their property. Several of our cities already had working ADU ordinances, but they didn't include all of these new conditions. And so we put a model ordinance together for them that they can adjust for, you know, local issues and local concerns. And, you know, they're getting to work on that. And the same thing with House Bill 2721 and 2297. Now, 2721 is what we call the middle housing bill. That's mm-hmm. the bill that allows them to build townhomes and plexus. That one doesn't become effective until January 1 of 2026. But contemplating where those new types of homes are going to go and under what conditions, again, this isn't something that's a part of city and town ordinances right now. So we have a model ordinance that we're putting together for that, that we're working with the attorneys on. House Bill 2297 is what we call adaptive reuse. And so that's commercial property that, you know, you might think of like of a strip mall area. And so this is the ability to convert that type of property into housing. And again, a model ordinance is necessary to be put into place so that builders will know, okay, you know, that area can be used for adaptive reuse. And so this is a very important part of what they're doing, is getting these ordinances in place so that they can legally do the things that they need to do to comply with the law.
So there is, of course, some disagreement about whether certain cities are, in fact, complying with the law. I know that there's been some disagreement between some members, for example, of the Scottsdale City Council and Republican legislative leadership about one of the ordinances that the Scottsdale Council passed not that long ago, dealing with the percentage of commercial buildings that could be taken and turned into housing. I'm curious how you anticipate those kinds of disputes being settled. I mean, do they have to go to court? Are these, this has been an issue that the cities and the legislature have been fighting over pretty vehemently for a couple of years now. Is this one that can be settled through negotiation, do you think?
Well, to me, that's going to be a question that has to be answered in some respects by those individual cities. We are trying to create a situation in which there's clarity about what exactly needs to be done. And so I think that, unfortunately, some of those may end up in court, but what we're trying to do here, and the only thing that I can really comment on, is that we're trying to create clarity for the cities and towns so that they know what they need to do to comply with the law. And where they end up going, that's an individual city decision. And so that I kind of have to leave that to them.
Okay. Do you anticipate that there might be more disputes between the state and its cities over sort of how to interpret the laws or how to implement the laws on the city or town level?
Maybe. What I have found so far, you know, is that the vast majority of the stuff that we're hearing is preparation for compliance with the statute. And so that's all really I can comment on, is that most of our cities and towns are adopting ordinances and feel that they're prepared to start complying with the statute when it becomes effective.
What are you hearing about whether or not housing will continue to be an issue when the new legislature convenes in January? And I'm wondering maybe if the League and its member cities and towns have ideas or bills that you would like to put forward about how to deal with the ongoing housing crisis.
We know that it's going to be, there's a, you know, a Starter Home Act that didn't get passed last year. We are working on coming up with agreement amongst the cities about what we're going to put into our bill. But the actual policy decisions that will go into that have not been made yet, but it is something that will be part of the legislative debate next year. I think we will continue to have those policy debates over there next year about how properly to deal with it. We would like the legislature to take a look at not only how does city regulation affect building, but what are we doing as a state to deal with some really important macroeconomic issues like workforce, materials, interest rates. Those have a lot more to do with the price of housing than city regulation does. But we've completely focused on that and helping cities and towns to be able to put in infrastructure for the housing that should be built. So we're hoping also that we'll look at other things besides just city regulations, planning and zoning as part of what's going to come up next year.
All right. That is Tom Belshe, Executive Director of the League of Arizona Cities and Towns. Tom, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, the food that comes with the holiday season brings up complicated feelings for some. We'll hear one of the latest essays in our series, Eating Christmas.
But first, South Korean lawmakers have voted to impeach that country's president after he controversially declared martial law. With me via Skype for our weekly look at some of the key global stories in the coming days is the BBC's Pete Ross in London. And Pete, let's start there. What is the latest from South Korea and what might happen next?
Yeah, well, today, this story is moving pretty fast since the president, Yoon Suk-yeol, was impeached on Saturday. Currently, South Korea's constitutional court has begun the trial proceedings following that. for the impeachment of the president, who has now been suspended. And that was for declaring martial law and plunging his country into political turmoil it's currently facing. You might remember a couple of weeks ago, over the weekend, Yoon attempted to install martial law to basically take control with the military when he ordered troops to storm the parliament building and keep opposition politicians out. Now, even though he made that announcement late at night, protesters quickly made their way to the parliament, and opposition politicians managed to break through those lines of military and voted to overturn the decision. So his attempt at installing martial law failed, and since then, he's faced huge protests and mounting pressure to resign. But until now, he's refused to go. Yoon narrowly survived an impeachment attempt the previous weekend after members of his People Power Party boycotted that motion. And that led to more pressure and more protests and growing pressure on the PPP, the People Power Party. So we had the impeachment vote again on Saturday. That time it was successful. However, it does not mean he's gone for good. At the moment, he's suspended from his duties. And in the meantime, the Prime Minister has taken over his duties. So now the decision to impeach him has moved to the Constitutional Court, as I mentioned at the top there. And they now have 6 months to decide what happens next. It was thought that there would be some issue because at the moment, there's supposed to be 9 judges on that court and there's only 6. However, the Constitutional Court ruled today that it will be able to take move things forward with just 6 judges, and I think we will expect to see a decision on what happens next very soon. Just to say, there is precedent for this. 2 previous South Korean presidents have been impeached. One was upheld and they were kicked out of office. The other, they were found not to have been guilty or were not impeached, and they their power was restored.
Well, so Pete, as you referenced, President Yoon's bid to impose martial law was over basically almost as soon as it began. So why do you think it came to an end so quickly?
Well, just to mention, Mark, that I actually lived in South Korea for a few years. And I guess the first thing to say is that this was the first time martial law had been imposed in 45 years. And the last time it was imposed, it followed the assassination of a president, Lee, in 1979. There was a power vacuum. And in that time, the man that stepped into the breach imposed martial law in Seoul and then around the other major cities in South Korea. And it basically culminated in what's known as the May Uprisings in Gwangju, where thousands of students in that city took to the streets. And essentially, the army brutally put that down by opening fire with live rounds on the crowds. Now, the official death toll at the time and still to this day is just over 100. However, you know, that is widely contended, and many academics reckon that hundreds of people were slaughtered that day, if not even into the thousands. And so I think, while many people in Korea would not have been alive at that time, you know, you don't have to be alive to know your history. And I think, given the history the country has had with martial law and the fact that it's a pretty fledgling democracy, you know, a pretty young democracy, people want to defend that. And also, you know, they've got used to the armistice with, you know, they're still at war technically with the North. There was an armistice declared in the 1950s. And since then, the quality of life in Korea has rocketed. It's one of the richest countries in the world. The quality of life for most people there is of a good standard. And I think people want to hold on to that, and they want to hold on to those freedoms. And that shows why, even though Yoon made that decision to call martial law at night, why so many people came out so quickly, and why they remained there for the last 2 weeks in, you know, widespread protest.
Yeah, that is interesting. All right, so Pete, let's go now from South Korea to Russia, where President Vladimir Putin will hold his annual marathon news conference later this week. It's a combined news conference with President Putin also answering questions from members of the public. Why is this event so significant, and what might we expect from this?
Yeah, I'd say this annual event always throws up something interesting. And this year, if you consider the unfolding events in Syria and Russia's continued invasion of Ukraine, I think a lot of the world's media will be very interested in what President Putin has to say. Now, the event usually takes place in an exhibition hall near the Kremlin in a specially built TV studio packed with video screens, electronic tickers, Russian journalists, and even some foreign correspondents. They'll all be watching the Kremlin leader host this end-of-year news conference combined with a TV phone-in. Now, these two annual events used to happen separately at different times of the year, a big press conference, and then this kind of call-in with Putin, where President Putin invites members of the public to phone in and ask him questions, and he sort of gives them answers or attempts to solve their problems. Anyway, there's obviously going to be some very serious subjects, and as I said, not least Syria. If you think about the fall of the Assad regime in the last couple of weeks, which was in power there for the last 50 years, and certainly for the last 10 years or so, that was propped up by the military assistance of Russia. Now, there's two key military bases that Russia has in Syria that it will very much want to hold on to, and that is still up in the air at the moment as you know, events continue to unfold since the toppling of the regime there. Now, I'm not expecting Putin to address that particular issue directly, but he might do, and as I said, there are foreign journalists there, so one might ask him a question, and it'll be very interesting to see how he reacts and his comments on Syria and, of course, the war in Ukraine.
Indeed. All right. That is the BBC's Pete Ross in London. Pete, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Mark.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. And now it's time for another Tiny Desert concert. Jason P. Woodbury has been in band since he was in middle school. As he got older, he focused more on producing music as well as writing and podcasting about it. Now he hosts the Aquarium Drunkard Transmissions podcast and is the creative director of Wastoids. Woodbury says when the pandemic started and he had more time to himself, songs started tumbling out. JPW is the first project where he's taken the lead on singing and songwriting. But as he told the show's Sam Dingman, JPW isn't Woodbury's first time leading a musical group.
I grew up singing in my family's church in Coolidge, Arizona, and I was even like at a pretty young age brought in to like lead the singing. So like a prepubescent JPW was like leading singing, and then a postpubescent one as well.
And I'm imagining the songs you were singing in church were religious in nature.
No, all Scorpions and Megadeth. No.
Can I join your church?
Yeah, it was a cool church. No, all you know, very traditional Protestant hymnal, whatever that would be, you know. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because I don't think that sort of sacred or religious or mystical quality has ever really left what I do.
I'm glad you brought that up too, because I know obviously we're talking about a very small sample size of your songwriting oeuvre here tonight, just three songs, but it does seem like they share a preoccupation with whether or not to trust feelings, kind of gazing at things that are being seen through mediation, whether it's eyelids or mist or water. Mm-hmm. Do you find yourself as a songwriter returning to certain themes over and over again?
Yeah, and when I was younger, it really bothered me because I was like, I'm always writing about the same thing. But I think, at least for me as an artist, it's just been learning to like accept that those preoccupations are there, and that maybe the most like true thing I can do is sort of run towards them. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I became familiar with your work through your commentary and analysis of music on the Transmissions podcast and in other places. Help me connect the dots between your life as somebody who talks to musicians, somebody who analyzes music, somebody who understands it at a kind of theoretical level, and somebody who makes music.
Yeah, boy, I don't know how to untangle it all. You know, it's like in listening to other people's art, I feel like I gain the ability to synthesize my own feelings through somebody else's work, right? And so that's what draws me to music. That's what draws me in, is that I feel like the best music for me creates a space for the listener to enter into something, you know, whatever that is.
Can you think of a moment in the Transmissions podcast, maybe there's been many of them, where you've been talking to a musician and you had this thought like, oh my God, they just said the thing that I have been trying to figure out in my own creative process.
Oh yeah. Actually, the most recent episode, the one that closed our ninth season, was an interview with Matthew Houck of Phosphorescent. And listening back to it, I was like, oh my gosh, like I was really talking a lot in this one. You know what I mean? Like, and I was really nervous about that. But then when I was listening back to it, there were these things where I would say something and he would say, I felt like you were like a fly on the wall. Like, that's exactly what I was trying to write about. Like he said to me, it's validating for you to hear those things and to remark on them and to like confirm for me that they're in there.
I feel like you're describing my favorite kind of artist interview, where you're talking to Matthew and you in the interview don't necessarily know what you're looking for other than to get closer to whatever his source is.
Yeah.
And he as a songwriter maybe doesn't even really know what he's writing about other than he's just trying to channel what's coming from the source, and you kind of find it together.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think that's another thing that just over and over again I've heard from almost every songwriter I've worked with or talked to. I mean, the song comes from somewhere else and you have to just like make room for it. That's something I've experienced. You could think of it as, I don't know if you want to get mystical, some sort of shared thing that you're feeling and I'm feeling, and you listen to a song and you're like, this song is saying it for me. It's saying what I don't have the ability to say. And I think that's awesome.
I have to look at my notes because yeah. what you just said makes me think of my favorite lyric from Everybody's Talking,
okay.
which is rolling on the right track somehow.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like you found it.
Yeah,
and you don't know how you got there.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Everybody's talking about moving away. You think you'll be sticking around. Know you're on the right track somehow. Know you're on the right track somehow. Know you're on the right track somehow. That song, for whatever reason, guess I was probably just, I'm just getting to the age where it's like I start to remember who I was as a really young kid. And that know you're on the right track somehow line is like me now telling the kid, like, don't worry, you're on the right track. You're not going to know that. You're just going to have to keep going. But it is the right track somehow.
Yeah. It makes me think about what you were saying, where yeah. you keep trying to write about different things. And in the end, you keep writing about
yeah.
the same things over and over again.
Absolutely.
Let's talk a little bit about the sound of these particular songs.
Mm, sure.
One of the things I was noticing is that you're playing a 12-string guitar.
Mm-hmm.
Between the 12-string and the harmony that you and Zach are singing in and the pedal steel, the word that kept coming to mind to me in listening to you is like shimmer.
Ooh, cool. I love that.
Which I guess it feels related to me to this idea of something sort of ethereal, unknowable, that you can't quite place. That is there in the lyrics, but it's also there sonically.
I mean, that's awesome to hear. We put a premium on, you know, mood and atmosphere and trying to create that sort of stuff and make sure that the song has like a little bit of a cinematic attempt at creating like mood. And that's really important to me in any music I like, is that there's like an ambience that kind of carries through or unites it.
I have to say it's such a thread in this conversation, but I feel like you're articulating this thing that is so hard to articulate so much of the time, which is that the secret to really great songwriting and maybe just art is less craft and more like knowing what to follow.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm not a lot of chords guy. And to me, I think if you've got a pretty good melody and a hook somewhere in there and lyrics that you can sort of stand behind, I tend to think that's all you need.
All right, so Jason, we're going to go to one of your songs now. Tell us what we're about to hear.
This is When I Get Lonesome.
Place when I get lonesome again, know that you
guess it depends. Is or ain't you my friends? Think I wear my burden blank upon my face, but I've been off and drifting up in outer space. When I get lonesome again, know that you'll hear from me then. When I get lonesome again, when I get lonesome.
All right, well, I've been talking with Jason P. Woodbury, known musically as JPW. Jason, thank you so much.
Sam, thanks so much, man. It's such a huge, huge pleasure to get a chance to talk about this stuff.
Tell us what you're going to take us out on.
I think we're going to hear Wealth of the Canyon.
That was Jason P. Woodbury, musically known as JPW. His forthcoming album with Phoenix musician Dad Weed, Amassed Like a Rat King, comes out in early February. You can watch the full Tiny Desert concert on our YouTube channel, KJZZ Phoenix. And you are listening to the show. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. And it's the holiday season, and that means you may be, like me, listening to Christmas music on loop. So now let's talk to someone else who spends a lot of time this year listening to it. Julie Mahoney is the conductor of the East Valley Pops Orchestra, an orchestra made up of mostly retirees and snowbirds who are playing Christmas music all over town this time of year. For Mahoney, it includes some of her favorite performance moments. I sat down with her in our studios recently to talk more about it, beginning with her history in music, which she says has always been a part of her life. From piano lessons starting at age 4 to majoring in music in college to becoming a music teacher. She also has been involved in community orchestras, and that's how she ended up leading the East Valley Pops Orchestra, which she has been doing now for 31 seasons.
I had joined a string quartet, and the second violinist was involved in this orchestra, which at that time was called the Citrus Gardens Concert Orchestra.
Okay.
And so because she was my friend, and she'd say, oh, well, the Citrus Gardens Orchestra is putting on a concert. Would you like to come? Of course I'll come and support my friend. And so I'd heard the orchestra once or twice. Well, one day, Olive, this string quartet member, said to me, now, Julie, would you be interested in conducting our orchestra? And I didn't think about it very long. I said, well, sure, I'd be interested. So they set up an interview for me to meet with some of the board members who were, as I recall, it was three gentlemen. Hmm. And it's funny because as I left the house that day, my husband said to me, oh, they're not going to want a youngster like you conducting the orchestra. Because I was like 40, and these are all retirees, probably mostly 60s, 70s, whatever. I just shrugged my shoulders and said, well, hey, I'm going for the interview. We'll see what happens. Mm-hmm. Well, it's kind of interesting because when I got home, I said, well, Skeets, I said, that's my husband's nickname. Mm-hmm. I said, I'm going to do it. I'm going to conduct the orchestra. And I laughed and said, but you know what? I don't think they had any issue at all with my age. I think they were just a little hesitant about having a woman conductor.
Well, and that's rare, right? Women are not often conductors.
Well, 30 years ago.
Especially 30 years
ago. More rare. Not unheard of, but yes, 30 years ago, more rare. Today, more and more at the professional level, more and more female conductors are coming to the fore and being recognized as outstanding conductors.
How'd you overcome it? How'd you convince them it didn't matter?
Well, here was the deal I struck, because I didn't want to be saddled with a sad orchestra that wasn't going anywhere. Mm-hmm. So what I told these gentlemen was, let's have this be a one-year trial period. And if I feel like I'm not making progress, then I'll just say, well, thank you, you're a great bunch, but I'm going to step away. On the other hand, if all of you feel like she's not working for us, she's not a good fit, then you can just say, thank you for your service, we're going to look elsewhere.
Okay.
So that was the deal we struck. And I mean, honestly, I'm not really bragging, but I mean, they were just so happy to have a person who really knew what they were doing. And I like to say I have a great way of working with people. I keep things positive. I'm not overly critical. I never say, oh, that sounded awful. Mm-hmm. And they were encouraged and they worked hard and they got better. Well, every year they just got better and better.
And now it's your 31st season.
Yeah. Exactly.
So tell us more about this particular orchestra, because it does sound unique. It turns out there are actually kind of a lot of bands, orchestras like this around town, but not very many made up of mostly retirees like this one.
Well, that's true. And there certainly are a number of community orchestras, but we are an orchestra of mostly retirees and with many winter visitors as well. About a third of our membership is winter visitors.
Okay.
But also out in the East Valley, there's lots of these, well, I call them park bands, because the RV parks, the mobile home parks, or even the retirement communities, they'll have their own little concert band.
Sure.
But we're the only orchestra.
Huh.
And we're kind of unique in that we're a road band. We haul all our equipment in a trailer and we go to this park and that retirement community and this senior center, and we're traveling all over the place to put on our concerts.
That's great. So tell us about conducting an orchestra full of retirees, mostly seniors. Are there some challenges in that? Are there some really beautiful things?
Well, both. Both, definitely. The challenges are probably just, to a certain extent, endurance, you know, for the senior citizen who might have arthritis in their hands, yeah, for example, or maybe have some breathing issues or heart issues. You know, it can be a long rehearsal, a long 2-hour rehearsal for them. Also, we have different challenges physically with eyesight, hearing. That's always a big issue. Hearing. We have a few people that have issues hearing. And so I'm always mic'd for our rehearsals. So those would be some of the challenges. But the pluses are the enthusiasm that these retirees have. I mean, there are a lot of members of this orchestra. It's like their whole season revolves around playing in this orchestra. It's just like the biggest part of their season. And for many of them, it's the only group they play in, or maybe one of just maybe two. But the love of music, just the joy they have playing and performing, I mean, that's a huge plus.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, who is it who plays? Is it a lot of former musicians, people who played all their lives? Have they been professional musicians in the past?
We have a lot of retired music educators in the group. Yes, indeed. But we have people that maybe played an instrument all through school, and then they went to college and majored in engineering or mm-hmm. whatever, and got married, raised their children. Now they're retired and they're going, well, what am I going to do with my retirement? Well, say, I've got this trumpet in the back of my closet. I've got this violin under my bed. I'm going to dust this off and see if I can still play this thing. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of them are people that are returning to their instrument after a long absence.
Yeah, that's lovely. What about for you, Julie? Like, what has this meant to you? 31 years is a long time to spend doing anything. And it sounds like you're really passionate about it.
Oh, well, Yes. Ask anyone in the orchestra. I love it. I love doing it. Well, I wouldn't do it if I didn't love it, because it's hard work. When I lost my husband 7 years ago, it was just a great place for me to return to with all these people. I mean, to me, they're not just orchestra members. They're my friends. You know, they're my huge circle of 65 friends or 70 friends. And it was invaluable in helping me cope with the loss of my husband. The friendship, the support, but just being able to kind of escape in the music, to turn all my thoughts toward rehearsing the orchestra, making them better, and then I could forget about my grief temporarily.
Yeah, yeah. So let's talk about the music a little bit. You're in the middle of this holiday concert season when lots of folks will be out playing lots of holiday music.
Yes.
What does that mean for you? Are there certain songs you always play because you have to and you love them, or do you mix it up?
Well, fortunately, there's a wide variety of Christmas music available. There's so much to choose from, so it's not like we're doing the same thing every single year. And really, that's more for our own sanity than for the audience, you know. But the one piece that we do tend to repeat, if not every year, but we've played it a lot, is the Mannheim Steamroller arrangement of Stille Nacht, well, Silent Night, which they entitled Stille Nacht.
Yeah.
Absolutely gorgeous. I think I could maybe say it's my favorite Christmas selection of all. Of course, I listen to it at home on CD. And I'm fortunate to have a fabulous principal cellist, Margaret Kauger, and my associate conductor plays the keyboard, and they have this beautiful duet at the beginning, just the two of them. I mean, the audience is totally silent. It's just so beautiful. And then the orchestra kind of quietly comes in, and it's just a fabulous piece. So that's my favorite. That's the one we play the most.
All right. We'll take it out on that one. That is Julie Mahoney, conductor of the East Valley Pops Orchestra, joining us. Julie, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
What goes together better than food and the holidays? Well, lots of things, if you ask Anna Michael Sussman. But they've made their peace with Christmas fare. Here's Sussman with an essay performed live last week at the Eating Christmas Show at Crescent Ballroom in Phoenix.
My first memory of the holidays is the brilliant six-pointed tinfoil star sitting on top of our tiny plastic Christmas tree. The Hanukkah bush, as my parents called it. None of the kids at my Hebrew school had a Hanukkah bush. My family is technically what could be called interfaith, so my relationship to the holidays is already unorthodox. My father's parents, capital J Jewish. My mother's side is a bit more complex. Her mother, my grandmother, is the daughter of an English Anglican priest. And her father, my grandfather, was a German-Jewish Holocaust survivor. So, complex. Because of this, my mother, though raised Jewish, still grew up with a big decorated tree and a stocking, as well as a classic English Christmas dinner of figgy pudding and a roast goose. She wanted me to experience her mother's Christmas traditions as well. But my father, although not at all religious, was vehemently opposed to anything Christmas. In fact, I learned recently, he barely agreed to the Hanukkah bush. Massive hater. Another complicated aspect of the holidays was my father's terrible relationship with food. His mother would say that he had two modes, starving and sick. Unfortunately, he gifted me this trait. I would slam an entire plate, barely chew, and then wonder why I felt like shit, which is, shockingly, I have come to find out, not healthy. I was probably 12 the first time my father made a negative comment about my weight. I had been taking circus classes, and my new dream was to be in Cirque du Soleil. I told him this, excitedly. He looked me up and down and said, "Honey, I don't think you have the right body type for that." What? I had always been a skinny little kid, so up until this point, I was eager to grow up and fill out and look more like the celebrities that I idolized. I didn't even notice I had slid down the other side of the double-edged sword wielded against young women. You should only take up space in designated places. An idea sold to us before we even knew we were buying. And I bought. And eventually, I realized the biggest salesman was my father. This will be my 8th Christmas without seeing my father. Even though I have never regretted cutting off contact, every December feels a little bit like a stomach ache. It's not debilitating, but it's there, and it hurts. And even now, as I think about the Yorkshire pudding and the latkes and my stepdad's incredible frosted angel cookies, I feel my father's presence leering from afar like a fat-phobic Christmas ghost. When I feel this ache, I try to remember that that's healing. That's the natural process of grief that comes with losing a parent, regardless of circumstance. And it may ache a little forever, but it can't hurt me. So I focus instead on how beautiful my holidays are now in this life that I've created. My family setting up the tree together, a big living tree now, but still with the tinfoil star. Making and eating whatever food I crave without guilt because I deserve to. And spending as much time as I possibly can with the people I love and who choose to love me.
That was Anna Michael Sussman. To hear their essay and more from the Eating Christmas series, visit kjzz.org.
All right, that'll do it for this Monday edition of the show. We will be back with you again tomorrow morning with much more, as always. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ, the show. For Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.
That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.